On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. What the heck is going on in Denver? And is Denver's dependence on Jokic at all sustainable? Plus, we're joined by Portland Trailblazers forward Temani Kamara. All that and more coming up next. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's The Big Number. As always, we do this show every Thursday at Yahoo Sports. Dan, what's going on, man?
Tom, have either of us been fired since the start of this podcast? It's late in the season, but apparently that doesn't matter anymore. Are you aware?
Well, if it's anything like the Denver Nuggets, it's not just us. It's going to be everyone upstairs too. Cleaning house. This is a crazy week in the NBA. Like, we thought Taylor Jenkins was the craziest coaching firing in NBA history, but guess what? Hold my beer, says the Denver Nuggets. That's what we're going to do for this week's big number. This week's big number is two, as in the championship curse rule of two. I am coining it. It is absurd. But if you look back on like the last seven champions, like taking out the Boston Celtics of last year, but every champion since like 2018, after 2 years after winning the title, something terrible happens to your franchise that either makes you want to fire your coach or says, yeah, I don't want to have to make the playoffs. Like, 2 years, that's it. We're not talking 5 years down the line or 10 years down the line. If you look at the 2018 Golden State Warriors, 2 years later, they missed the playoffs. 2019, Toronto Raptors. 2 years later, they missed the playoffs. 2020, Lakers. Frank Vogel, 2 years later, fired, missed the playoffs. 2021, the Milwaukee Bucks. Coach fired. Sorry, Mike Budenholzer. 2022, Golden State Warriors. 2 years later, they missed the playoffs. Steve Kerr, still head coach. But 2023, Denver Nuggets. Mike Malone, less than two full seasons. Three games left before the postseason starts. A mere hours after Taylor Jenkins melted our faces off that the Memphis Grizzlies and Zach Kleiman said, we have a sense of urgency around here, so we're going to wait until right before the postseason to fire our coach and two assistant coaches. And the Denver Nuggets and Josh Kroenke were like, look, watch this. Right before the postseason, we're going to fire the head coach of a leading MVP candidate, Jokic, and we're going to tell Calvin Booth, our GM, that was the GM during the 2023 NBA Finals Championship, even though a lot of the core and a lot of the team was constructed by the previous GM, Tim Connelly, and they decide, yep, he's gone too. So, Dan, I'm wondering, after watching this, from the Memphis Grizzlies, where we're watching and doing a pod a week ago talking about how this is the most insane coaching firing in NBA history. And then a week later, everything is undone. And now we have a new bar that we have to set. On the scale of like Dan Devine's Richter scale, like 1 to 10, how stunning was this? Or you've reached the point with after the Luka trade and after the Taylor Jenkins thing that you're just like numb to it all.
It is, at this point, there's nothing, it feels like the box has been opened and we can't, it's not going to close again. Like, everything is possible, all is permitted, everything can happen. If Luka can get traded for Anthony Davis in the middle of the night, then sure, teams can fire their coaches 3 games before. They maybe have home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs. What the hell? Why not? Who cares? The thing I kept thinking of was, so I was in the locker room the night the Nuggets won the championship. I was covering that game and I got to be in the locker room the night and I was talking to Calvin Booth and I asked him like, so like, I mean, I know it's this job is all work, but like, how long do you get to enjoy this? And he was like, tomorrow morning, we got a meeting about like draft prospects. And all I could think about is like, man, you should have taken a little bit more time and enjoyed some beers, brother. Like, you know, because who knows, the job won't love you back. Anyway. This is, but even if in a world where 2 hours after these things happen, local reporters say like, it's ultimately unsurprising. It was surprising. Everyone was pretty surprised. And we should be shocked by this. It's 3 games before the end of the season, as you mentioned, 5 days before the end of the regular season. The latest firing of any coach, I believe, since Hubie Brown 44 years ago. And a coach that was the winningest coach in franchise history, the coach of the only championship team in franchise history, and the general manager. Like, I don't know when the last time was that the entire apparatus got sent out the door, let alone this late in the game. It's nuts. It's, I mean, we are recording this before the Nuggets Wednesday night game against the Kings. Who knows? By the time this comes out, the Kings could be in fourth in the West. It's all like the pressure and the intensity on each line in the standings, each round in the postseason, how far you get, what kind of gate revenue that generates, all that. Seems like everything is so intense right now that it's everybody's losing their minds.
Yeah, I was losing my mind, and I was recording another podcast at the same time, and I was like, wait, that can we check? Is that a Centel? Is that Centel? Like, that's now where it is, where the NBA is outdoing NBA Centel, where you're like, I have to verify this fact from Shams Charania. Every time he tweets now, I'm like, you know what? I'm not even going to check Centel, like, see if it's got like the right, not a total misinformation campaign, because that's where the NBA is now. This is ludicrous. And it's like, well, you know, we hold ourselves to a high standard, and we'll get to Josh Kroenke's comments that he gave to the TV network. But it just seems like, you know, the whole argument this year for the debate between Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Nikola Jokic has been underpinned by the fact that, like, the Thunder are still pretty good without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Like, they're still going to be a really good team. The thing that was like boosting Jokic's candidacy beyond the fact that he's averaging a triple-double was that they can't play basketball without Jokic on the floor. And you know who agrees with that? The Kroenkes. Yeah. They were like, yeah, you know what? This is crazy. Like, this is nuts that, like, Jokic, as good as he is, we could, as Josh Kroenke said on the record, he's like, we need to shake the tree to squeeze out more juice. A lot of metaphors in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy. But that is stunning. Also, something I've been harping on is, like, as good as Jamal Murray and Aaron Gordon and Michael Porter Jr. are, I had to write this column for Yahoo Sports. Go read it now if you haven't. Nikola Jokic is the first MVP since I tracked this in 1984. So what is that? 50 years, 40 years, carry the two. 40 years of MVPs. This is the first one, Dan, in which an MVP in his first 10 years of his career has never had an all-star teammate, an all-NBA teammate, or an all-defensive team, first or second team, all-defense, first or second team teammate while playing with that teammate. It's never happened. In fact, of the last, 24 MVPs, the average number of teammate awards, all league teammate awards, is 16 for those MVPs, and Jokic has zero. So what we're seeing here is an organization that has said enough. Like, we need more help around Jokic. Obviously, Calvin Booth, you're out of here. And we need someone to better align those talents. Jamal Murray, he got called out by Michael Malone. Not called out. I mean, it's weird to say or to, like, caveat, because, like, Michael Malone's now fired. So maybe the ownership was reading into these comments like I was. But he was like, this hamstring injury used to be day by day, but now it's super weird. And it's a weird one. Who knows if he'll be back before the end of the before the start of the playoffs. And there's just been a lot of, like, really strong comments from Michael Malone. And I was like, the organization has to be backing that guy because he feels like he can speak his mind. And evidently, nope. And Dan, that's probably not even the craziest or the strongest Michael Malone comments, the one about Jamal Murray recently. There's been another one that's been surfacing after he played the Portland Trailblazers.
Yeah, it was after a recent loss to the Portland Trailblazers, which on one hand is not the, you know, badge of dishonor it might have once been, because the Blazers have been playing pretty great ball for a while now. But still, you're a team with championship aspirations. That's a game you'd like to think you go in there and you come out with a W. And afterward, Michael Malone, being very clear, said, like, about the accountability or lack thereof, like, quote, they're not going to go back and watch their minutes because nobody watches their minutes. Nobody watches film. So we'll have to show them the film. And it's like, that is about as bald and brazen a call out of your players' lack of professionalism, their lack of engagement as it gets. And I think what we've learned since, or what it indicates since, is that's also Michael Malone kind of laying it bare. They're not listening to me anymore. And so we talked about you mentioned the Zach Kleiman urgency as a core principle thing. And, you know, Josh Kroenke was intimated similar things in his post-firing comments. There is a sense that, like, if we think this has run its course, then why wait? You know, if we don't feel confident that this iteration of the team whether because of the decisions that Calvin Booth made in roster management, because of the decisions that Michael Malone has made in the way he deploys that roster, because of the health and availability of our, you know, critical number two player, because of and number three player in Aaron Gordon, and because of the maybe lack of overall growth of our other important player, Michael Porter Jr., whatever the reasons are that we got here, if we don't think this team has a ceiling that goes beyond maybe play in maybe first round, then as currently constituted, then why not make this change now? But I think the thing that was most interesting to me about that is, you mentioned Josh Kroenke had an interview with the team owned Altitude Sports outlet, and the quotes, the lines that he was saying was like, there were certain trends that were very worrisome to me, but they get masked by a few wins here and there. And as you know, in the world of professional sports, when winning and losing is your currency, winning can mask a lot of things. Okay, so first off, don't win. Bad. It's bad when you win.
Masking.
No good, very bad. Don't
bad
do it.
Things. Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's more to that group than has been accomplished so far. How much more is in that group? I don't think I know the answer. I don't think anyone knows the answer to that. But I have a belief that there's more in that group that can be accomplished. And I look forward to seeing what they can do. So on one hand, it's the mix we've got right now with front office, with coaching, whatever. It's not getting it done. We believe in this roster, though. We believe there's a championship team in here that wasn't getting put on the floor properly. And so now it's to David Adelman to find out if he can do the same, or if he can, you know, solve the puzzle in a way that Michael Malone was no longer able to, get that buy-in in a way that he was no longer able to, and to do it with three games of training wheels or runway before you head into, you know, potentially a win or go home game or a first round series on the road. It's an awfully intense situation.
Dude, Dan, they got swept by the Washington Wizards this year.
Is that a bad sign, right? That shouldn't happen.
Loss is also mask, I guess, because he didn't get fired after that. Like, if you're losing to the Washington Wizards, arguably the worst team in NBA history by point differential, then maybe this isn't working out. That was March 15th. We waited a month after they lost to the Washington Wizards for the second time this year. You're trying to win a championship, and your floor is losing to the Kyle Kuzma-less. Kyle Kuzma-less is a great, great word. It sounds like a cloud of some sort, a Kuzma-less. If you lose to that Wizards team, that's it. Like, you've seen enough. But apparently, now this four-game skid, Jamal Murray's been out. It just seems like this is a sense of urgency, but in a way, it's the opposite. Like, if you had feelings about this was not going in the right direction, do this before you get like to the trade deadline so you can make some changes at the trade deadline. Calvin Booth has been notoriously slow in terms of the activity at the trade deadline. Not many midseason trades. He let Kentavious Caldwell-Pope so he could go pay Christian Brown. Christian Brown's been great. But like the idea is they signed Jamal Murray to a large contract. There's a lot of stuff on the books going forward. And I'm looking at this situation and I'm saying, man, they got to be so thankful that Jokic is the most even-keeled superstar in the NBA, that he has never been one to pound his chest and demand more from the front office, publicly at least. We don't know what happens behind closed doors or what he says at his horse races. But what we do know is that in NBA history, there haven't been a lot of guys who have not played with a co-pilot or a star player. Michael had Scottie Pippen. KG was the most starless before this. The guy who had the fewest number of all-star appearances by teammates since, like, ever. He had Tom Gugliotta in his second year in the league. Tom Googs, all-star. He had Sam Cassell, all-NBA second team. He had Wally Szczerbiak. Jokic would dream for guys who were that well-regarded or that good at least once. And that's not to say Aaron Gordon and Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. are bad. It's just, I feel like Jokic, we would have a much different appraisal of how good he is if he wasn't supposed to shoulder all of this offense. And we're going to talk about this in the four little numbers. We're also going to talk to a guy who would look very good next to Nikola Jokic, because Jokic has never had an all defensive player, first or second team on his team ever. Tamani Kamara of the Portland Trailblazers. We're going to talk to him later in the show, joining the big number later in this program. We're going to also talk about the four things that the Denver Nuggets, without Calvin Booth and without Michael Malone, need to do from starting now to this offseason to keep Nikola Jokic happy. And as I wrote about on Yahoo Sports, I wouldn't be surprised if any other player, given the fact that the supporting cast has been this poor by historical standards, that they would ask for a trade. They would ask out. But I would be surprised if it was Jokic, because it's just not in his DNA. But if they are not going to have that problem on their hands, they need to do four things. And let's talk about it after the breakdown. All right. As a reminder, we're going to talk to defensive wing, defensive maestro, Tamani Kamara, and he's going to do some gestures, some miming for us on the program. Later coming up, we'll bring him onto the show. But first, let's hear your four little numbers, Dan. What's the first one?
First little number this week is 4.8%. Going back to the 2003-04 season, we've had 84 teams make the conference finals, right? 21 years, four teams, 84. Only four of those 84 teams, 4.8%, have finished the regular season 20th or worse in defensive efficiency, according to our friends at Cleaning the Glass. So 84 teams, four of them have finished 20th or worse in defensive efficiency and still made it to the final four. Those teams, last year's Pacers, they were 24th. LeBron's final two Cavs teams, 2016-17, 17-18, they were 21st and 29th, respectively, before they flipped the switch. And the 2009-10 Suns, that's not a 7 seconds or less team. That's an Alvin Gentry Suns team after the initial sort of thrust of the Suns. They were 20th. So
The 80 others that were this bad defensively were not making it to the conference finals.
Yeah, the 80 other teams were all like middle of the pack or above, and overwhelmingly top five, top 10. So for the Nuggets to, you know, if Josh Kroenke is saying, we believe there's more in here, we believe there's a mix in here, for it to get to that level, it would be a pretty significant historical outlier for the last couple of decades of NBA basketball. And the formula looks something like friendly path in the first couple of rounds, like Indiana got Milwaukee without Giannis last year, and the Knicks had all the injuries in the second round. You have the best offense in the league. That was that Suns team. Or you have one of the greatest players of all time at the absolute peak of his powers, flipping the switch and deciding to just carry everyone like LeBron. It's not out of the realm of possibility that the Nuggets could do that. But like, I mean, there's a pathway. Say the hypothetical is like they land in the 4-5. They play the Clippers. Kawhi gets hurt. They deal with somebody in
basically the
second
Pacers
round.
Last year. The Pacers got to the conference finals because there was a bunch of injuries, and they had not to say that they weren't deserving.
Yes, but of course.
They faced a Bucks team, a Knicks team that were severely shorthanded, and that's kind of what you're praying for if you're the Nuggets. Is like a lot of things have to break our way, or else we're going to be a first-round sweep. Like, that is what we're looking at, is the Denver Nuggets. They've already decided, Dan, the coach is not good enough. The GM is not good enough. What is it going to take for the players to be like, yeah, we're not good enough this year? Like, I could understand if they were just like, this year's not our year.
Yeah, and just to lay it bare, because I don't know that we set it up front, the Nuggets are in the bottom third of the league in defensive efficiency. Since March 1st, the only teams that have had worse defenses than them are the Tankers, Philly, Charlotte, the San Antonio, Utah, and New Orleans, the injury-decimated Mavericks, and the hollowed-out husk of what used to be the Phoenix Suns. That's it. That's the level of defense that these teams, that this Denver Nuggets team has been playing for the last 5-6 weeks. It's the worst defense full season that Denver has had since Jokic became a full-time starter. So when you talk about those worrying trends, the, you know, winning has masked some bad trends. Josh Kroenke did have a point. This defense has been bad for a while, and it looks like it might be bad enough to keep them out of serious contention. As something that I read, I think it was maybe TomTheFinder.com, somebody smart that I know wrote about this Denver Nuggets defense not too long ago.
Yeah. The elephant in the room that, if the Kroenkes are not subscribers, they agree that the elephant in the room is that they are so bad defensively. This is unacceptable. Unacceptable.
Go into the luxury tax to subscribe to Tom's newsletter. Come on.
it's a few bucks here and there. But you know what? The front office for the Denver Nuggets have historically, their reputation has been that they are cheap. that they do not pay for talent. We saw Tim Connelly leave for a big package over in the Minnesota Timberwolves. I talked about Kevin Garnett and looking at how few stars that he had next to him during his tenure with the Minnesota Timberwolves. I remember talking to Chris Bosh in Miami in 2016, I want to say it was. And I was like, who was it that convinced you that you needed to leave Toronto? And he's like, it was Kevin Garnett. I was like, dude, but you hate that guy. He hates you. And he's like, no, we do. But like, honestly, I had talked to him at All-Star. It was, I think, 2010 All-Star, right before he left. And he's like, he had a heart-to-heart with KG and was like, yo, I don't know if I can keep doing this. Like, depending on the front office and the coaching staff here in Toronto, it's the team that drafted me. I feel like I have this loyalty to them. And he said it to reporters, but he also told Chris Bosh this, is like, man, loyalty can backfire at a certain point. And I think today's NBA player, superstar, feels that when Luka Doncic gets traded after winning the Western Conference Finals at 25 years old, is that like loyalty is overrated at a certain point. And Jokic, like, you're loyal to the Denver Nuggets and to Michael Malone and to Calvin Booth and Tim Connelly. They're all gone. And we have no idea how much Jokic had involved in that. I'm guessing not much, just because that's how Jokic is. But at the same time, it's like, if you're Jokic, can we please get some elite defenders and not let KCP go, let Bruce Brown go? And like, granted, there are some contractual things there that they got.
Yeah, CBA involved there.
But there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way with all these years of Jokic and his game that you can't surround him with better defensive talent. And Russell Westbrook isn't that. Right? Like, I'm sorry, he's not. And so the thing about Russell Westbrook was he was supposed to ease the burden on Jokic's offensive shouldering, like his offensive load, his responsibility offensively. But Dan, I kind of feel like it's almost more offensive responsibility for Jokic than he's ever had. Is there any number that can back me up on that?
Yeah, you're very right there, Tom Haberstroh. So our first little number was about the defensive work that needs to get done. We've got to figure out how to improve this 20th ranked defense, bottom third defense. Our second little number is 105.5. That's how many touches per game Nikola Jokic is averaging according to Second Spectrum tracking data this season. If it sounds like a lot, that's because it is. It not only leads the NBA, which is something that Jokic has done for the last 6 years, this will make seven, but it's also the highest number of his career. So he's led the NBA in touches per game for 6 years, going on seven. This is more than ever. It's about 3.5 per game more than last season, about 4.5 per game more than 21-22. That's the year where they didn't have Jamal Murray at all, when he was rehabbing his torn ACL.
So
everything was Jokic.
And it's more now.
It's 4.5 more per game now than it was during the no Jamal Murray at all season. And that higher workload shows up in other areas too. Like, second highest usage rate of his career, taking almost 20 shots per game, which would be a career high. Second highest time of possession of his entire career. All these indicators of just like how often he has the ball, how often he has to direct everything, how much he has to do himself, the degree to which his buckets are unassisted. All of these things. It's obviously resulted in incredible production. Like, we're talking about a 30-point triple-double damn near, and like his MVP case rests heavily on that. And the Nuggets offense is still awesome, but you'd have to figure that whoever makes up that Denver's next brain trust, they have to find a way to reduce this dependence, right?
Yeah, and look, I think that is an offensive stat, but I think you can spin it also as a defensive stat in the sense that this guy, when he's the closest defender at the rim, opponents are shooting 70% with Jokic guarding the rim. And a lot of that is because he's exhausted. You don't want to have this dude be also a rim protector, contesting the rim or drawing fouls at the rim, because he does everything. He is not just the sun, but all the planets, all the stars, all of the gravity in the entire solar system is Jokic offensively. So how could we possibly ask him to also be a rim protector? And that was one of the things I wrote about, is like, this is untenable. The offensive load is so insane on Jokic's shoulders that he's got to be the best three-point shooter, the best distributor, the best screen setter, the hub, the best dribbler, the best getting into our offense guy. And then, oh yeah, you got to go guard the paint the entire time, meet at the level and then run back to the rim and defend. It's insane to ask him to do both of those things. And so the elephant in the room was exactly that. There's too much on one side, and asking him to do anything defensively is, it's as the Kroenkes have demonstrated, it's unacceptable what they've done. So how do you get him to be a better rim protector, or at least have the energy to do that? You got to get more offense from the other guys. And Christian Brown, Michael Porter Jr., great cutters. But hey, can we get more offense out of them where they're creating more, or Jamal Murray, depending on him, to create more instead of just the one, the two-man game with Jokic? There's got to be other ways. There's got to be more ways to allow Jokic to be more than just a handsy guy defensively and be more, I don't know, able to move a lot more defensively and get to spots and not have to defend and have him putting out fires all the time defensively, because the team is not good defensively. I think 22nd adjusted defensive rating over at Dunks and Threes. So 20th is bad. But when you look at their strength of schedule, it even gets worse than that, worse than the Brooklyn Nets that are obviously trying to go for ping pong balls. They have a better defense. The Atlanta Hawks have a better defense than the Denver Nuggets. And I don't know if they have that other gear. But hey, the Kroenkes believe that they have a nut, more juice to squeeze. We'll see that coming up. What's your next one?
Well, I just have to say, I feel like I hear an army of James Harden, Trey Young, other stands being like, we've been saying this thing about the defense for years. Everyone got mad at how these guys weren't playing any defense. And now all of a sudden it's Jokic and it's okay. So I just want to say, I hear this coming from outside here in the avenue. So I just want to say, I hear you guys. Our third little number. So we talked about the defense needs to get better. We talked about there needs to be a little bit more diversification in terms of who else can do stuff on the offensive end. Third little number is 0.2, which is the total value over replacement player of every Nugget under age 25, or sorry, 25 and under. So part of the whole structure here was, if you're going to pay Jokic and you're going to pay Murray and you're going to pay Aaron Gordon and you're going to pay Michael Porter Jr., you've got that core four locked up, and that's going to give you the best starting five, or, you know, starting four in the world. And then you're going to have to fill in around the edges. And Calvin Booth's game plan was, we're going to do that with a bunch of young guys. We're going to maneuver to get multiple draft picks and, you know, guys in the high in the second round, low in the first round. And we're going to get like five or six dudes and we're going to develop. And that's what we're going to do. And Michael Malone was like, what if instead I didn't play any of those guys because I like veterans, and then I get real mad about it. And so we get to the end of the year and like nothing is positive. Everyone agrees on Christian Brown. No one agrees on anything else. So 0.2 is the total value of replacement player. Christian Brown is like above that. He's like, you know, up in the ones. And then the other guys are all bringing that down, basically, like negative value. And it's because, like, listen, Peyton Watson has shown real flashes, you know, quality defensive player, a lot of tools and a lot of potential, who isn't really a full-fledged offensive player yet, right? Julian Strother, kind of the reverse, and also was injured for a while. Zeke Nagy got a four-year deal for reasons that I think remain somewhat unclear, and he'll have some stretches where it's like, oh yes, switchable small ball big, and then some stretches where it's like, has that guy played in a game in a month? And no one really knows for sure. The real shame of this season was they trade up to go get De'Ron Holmes at the end of the first round, and then he tears his Achilles like first summer league game, so misses his entire rookie season. TBD on what he can do. Jalen Pickett, apparently we're finding out in the postmortem reporting, is like the line in the sand between between Michael Malone and Calvin Booth, as far as like, should he be playing over Russell Westbrook late in games? Do you trust him? I don't know, but like, and he's fine, but maybe not much more than that. We don't know. Hunter Tyson, I think, pretty TBD as far as what he can provide. And like, this is half your roster. That's like six guys that you've made this bet on. We need to develop these young guys because that's going to be the cheap support for our top heavy roster. And we just haven't seen it yet. So like, you'd imagine, given the state of the Nuggets balance sheet, which we'll talk about in a second, and given where they are in terms of their draft capital, which we'll talk about in a second, the next head coach has to have a plan to develop these young guys, right? Has to be willing to let them go more than Michael Malone would.
You know what's crazy? The Nuggets decided nobody was right in that. All of those guys,
yeah,
that you just
everyone
named,
was wrong.
Malone was wrong and Calvin Booth was wrong to get those guys. Like, that's crazy. Like, I understand if you're deciding, hey, we're going to let go of one of those two decision makers, one, Michael Malone, or the GM. They got rid of both. They got rid of both, Dan. That's, like you said, it cleaning house this late in the season displays an utter lack of trust in both of those top decision makers in the organization. You need your coach to be aligned with your star player, Jokic, and the GM. Anyone that is a broken link on that chain, that's a problem. But what if basically everyone above Jokic, between Jokic and the ownership, everything's broken in between that, and you're deciding that it's over, enough is enough, a week before the postseason begins? I have never seen that in the NBA. Usually you see a coach getting fired and then Zach Kleiman of the Memphis Grizzlies comes out and says, you know what? We have a sense of urgency here. It's my choice. And they just cleaned house. Like, that is such a statement that is so demonstrative. What Josh Kroenke did is like, yeah, they're both wrong. All the supporting cast and the player, the decisions to play or not to play, I think they're all wrong. I don't trust either of these guys to run my team going forward. That was crazy to me. So, they need to get better. Also, internal development, the coaching staff, Michael Malone. Wow. I just like, I don't know if we'll get any spicy comments from Jokic going forward, but that was as crazy. Like, man, think about it. Like, Luka Doncic getting traded was, it seems like a footnote. I think that's crazy. That's crazy that like a month ago, two moves would happen. The Memphis Grizzlies deciding, yeah, we're going to fire Taylor Jenkins, and then upended by Michael Malone and Calvin Booth getting let go 3 days before the three games before the postseason. That's nuts. But you know what? It's all coming to a head here because I kind of teased it. That they've been, you know, the reputation around the league. John Hollinger wrote this a couple years ago, is when Tim Connelly left to go to the Minnesota Timberwolves, that like they're not really breaking out the Brinks truck for their organization, their front office members, the GM, the coaches. And right when they do bring out the Brinks truck, it seems like they're going to blow this whole thing up. What's the next big number?
Yeah, so our fourth and final little number this week is actually, I think, the biggest number we've ever had on the show. And if it's not, I can't believe I'm forgetting it. But $230,485,420. That is how many dollars the Denver Nuggets owe Jamal Murray, Michael Porter Jr., and Aaron Gordon combined for the next two seasons, 2025 and 2026, according to SpotTrack contract data. Without making any new moves this summer, the Nuggets are going to project it to be about $4.7 million over the first apron next year and about $7 million under the second apron without doing anything. And as we've established, it seems pretty clear some stuff's going to need to happen. Christian Brown and Peyton Watson also extension eligible, which ought to be interesting come this summer. So we'll see what kind of decisions happen there. Given how limited their financial flexibility is, again, already over the apron for next year, and I mentioned the draft picks. They don't have any picks this summer from a couple of old trades. The Aaron Gordon trade, so their first goes to Orlando. Their second goes to Phoenix because of five other deals that happened. And they owe top five protected first in 2027 and 2029 to, guess who? The Oklahoma City Thunder, who have just been like the tractor beam of all draft picks. Because like that was like the arbitrage they did during the 2023 finals. We'll trade you our future picks so we can get a 2023 and a 2024 and a second rounder to take Peyton Watson and Hunter Tyson and be able to get Deron Holmes. Anyway, no new picks coming in, picks going out, no financial flexibility to speak of. Given all of that, how close might we be to finding out what the value is of a Jamal Murray or Michael Porter Jr. or Aaron Gordon on the trade block? Because I'm having a hard time finding we retrofit everything around Jokic pathways that don't involve that.
I think the time is now, obviously. Like, Kroenke is demonstrating, like, whoever was the architect on the floor and of the books, unacceptable, gone. We can't have this anymore. So we have to rethink everything. I don't think Josh Kroenke decided to fire Calvin Booth and Michael Malone to keep the status quo. There's no way. Question is, what kind of cents on the dollar are you going to be able to trade Jamal Murray, who his estimated plus minus this season ranks 60th in the NBA, and he just got maxed for the next 4 years.
Hasn't even kicked in yet. The extension starts next year.
Next year, $208 million coming to him, and he's demonstrated that he is a very slow starter. So if you're going to trade for Jamal Murray's four-year, $208 million contract, you have to be willing to stomach basically a month of that first deal. Jamal Murray is going to play himself into shape. And, oh, by the way, he is dealing with hamstring injuries continually. He's already torn his ACL. So his injury questions going forward made that max extension already dubious to begin with. And then he got his head coach, Michael Malone, being like, yep, that hamstring, don't know when he's going to be ready. And then he's fired. This is a really tough situation. I wonder what Jeff Schwartz thinks of all this. Now, Jeff Schwartz is a power agent for Excel Sports Management. He has more, according to some sources, has more millions of salary under contract than any other agent in the NBA. And Jeff Schwartz has 7 clients on the Denver Nuggets roster. That is the most clients for any agency or team in the NBA. So you think the CAA, Leon Roseniks, is crazy? They've got 5 players under CAA, and the Denver Nuggets had 7 under Excel, including Jokic, including Jamal Murray, including Russell Westbrook. Where should we find Russell Westbrook a home for this next year? And then magically happens, Jokic wants Russell Westbrook on his team. It's ebb and flowed. It's been up and down. But obviously, the organization decided that was not a great move, Calvin Booth, and that wasn't a great way to deploy Russell Westbrook or Pickett. You're out too. But there's DeAndre Jordan, Vlatko Koncar, Peyton Watson, and Dario Saric, all like, They're clients of Jeff Schwartz. So I'm wondering, like, to my third eye is opening on this a little bit, where I'm like, are we going to see like a Leon Rose move or a Rob Pelinka move or a Bob Myers move where the agent becomes the decision maker and tries to settle all of these books, where Jeff Schwartz is that Jeff Schwartz's music and he decides to take over the front office? I'm not saying that's going to happen, but crazier things have happened in this league. Leon Rose is leading the New York Knicks right now with Worldwide West, and one of his clients, Tom Thibodeau, is the coach. And oh, by the way, one of Leon Rose's number one clients, they just traded for Karl-Anthony Towns. So you can say this is a crazy plot, but who's going to figure out how to allocate this money or find the best places for Jamal Murray, for Nikola Jokic, or the best supporting cast for Jokic to finally find that all-star next to him? Maybe it's Jeff Schwartz. I don't know who Josh Kroenke wants to run that franchise. So we'll see.
Well, yeah, man. I mean, Tom, crazier things have happened. Like, for example, firing your championship-winning head coach 3 games before the end of the season.
Pretty drastic. Like, no, that's beyond the pale. Bringing on the agent for Jokic as the chief decision maker, that's crazy. That's totally off the charts. Meanwhile, firing Michael Malone right before the playoffs and firing the GM too. I have a theory that this is all because of Rob Pelinka and Nico Harrison meeting for coffee one day. Like, that is where this all germinates from, is that moment when Rob Pelinka was approached by Nico Harrison to trade Luka Doncic for Anthony Davis. That's when the rest of the NBA decided, yep, there are no more rules. We're done.
Yeah, we're playing Calvin Ball, but not Calvin Booth, apparently, unfortunately.
This is just crazy. The NBA. Hey, what if a player right before the postseason decides, I'm going to start a podcast with JJ Redick, who's working at ESPN, and then I'm going to decide that's going to be my head coach for my NBA team and hire that? That's just a minor blip on the radar of this NBA season, that JJ Redick is now the head coach for Luka Doncic in the Lakers. The NBA is crazy, man. You know what's also crazy is that a 52nd pick in the draft 2 years later is one of the best defenders in the NBA, an all-defense candidate, defensive player of the year candidate, number 2 in a statistical category that is going to blow your mind here. Tumani Kamara, Portland Trail Blazer wing stopper, is going to join us on The Big Number right after the break. Can't wait to talk to him. Dan, this is going to be a lot of fun. All right, here on The Big Number, we are joined now by Portland Trailblazer feared defender, wing Tumani Kamara. Dan, this is a first for us. We've got Tumani Kamara on the show. He's the a Belgian NBA player who's now, after a 52nd pick in the NBA, who has become one of the most feared dudes in the league. Tumani, thanks for hopping on with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I do the broadcast where we run the numbers on Tumani Kamara and all the different players, Dan, and the numbers that he comes up with, or the stats that he does, he makes my job very easy, because Tumani Kamara is second in the NBA in defensive stops. So we're adding his steals, his blocks that are recovered by the Blazers, and the offensive fouls that he's drawn. And he is second in the NBA, one of only two players who has more than 200 defensive stops this season. And Tumani, this is over 100 more stops than you had last season. So I'm wondering, like, what did you come into this year, Tumani, with like a goal of a number of stops or being an elite stopper? Like, what was on your agenda for this season coming into this, your second year in the NBA?
I think for me it was just to try to have the most impact that I can have on the basketball court, whether it's defensively, offensively. I try to be a better person, better player, more experienced, more mature. And I feel like defensively I was struggling a lot. A lot of good offensive player was able to take advantage of drawing fouls and stuff like that. So I wanted to find a way to draw more offensive foul on my side. So, I think I'm getting better at that every game.
Tumani, we talk on this show a lot about numbers as a way to sort of help tell the story of what's happening on the court, help explain for viewers what they're seeing game to game. But I know that the transition of numbers from like coaches to players, sometimes that can be a little bit tricky. I'm wondering, are there things that your coaches really hit on, like stats or numbers that they really want you to pay attention to focus on, things that they think will help with, you know, game planning or your player development? Any numbers or stats that they really focus on with you?
Not really. I wouldn't say number of stats. As of today, is more try to be the best player I can be. I'll try to have an impact on the game. And they kind of let me be myself, try to let me make mistakes and learn from them.
So one of the stats that I've been tracking is you're one of only one player. You're the only player to guard both Nikola Jokic and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the two front runners for MVP, only player in the NBA to guard each of those guys for at least 50 possessions. So I'm wondering, Tumani, can you share with us, what is the one thing you want to take away from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander when you're going against that dude? And then a Nikola Jokic, who's completely different assignment, a center rather than the point guard. What are you trying to do with Jokic as opposed to what are you trying to do with SGA?
I would say with SGA, he's very shifty, plays a lot of one-on-one ISO, a lot of, like, his mid-range, a lot of pump fakes, try to draw fouls and stuff like that. So the most important for me is try to stay in front of him, be solid, try to reach for the ball and stuff like that, because he has a very high IQ on that. And then try to make other players make plays, try to limit his possessions and then his touch. And same for Jokic, try to make as soon as he crosses half court, try to be physical with him, not letting him get into his spots. But he's a big body, he's really hard to maneuver, but he's, try to not let him breathe in a certain way. I feel like my speed and relentless, I think that's what kind of helped me against him for sure.
Well, building off that, those obviously two of the toughest covers in the league, and that's the kind of assignment you've been drawing an awful lot this season. Here's another number that matches the eye test. You rank in the 99th percentile in average matchup difficulty. 99, very close to 100, right at the top of that list. Guys like Lou Dort, Dyson Daniels, and Tumani Kamara. Walk us through what it's like to prepare for those sorts of challenges. You know, what does it take, mentality, preparation, to get ready for that sort of challenge of dealing with the best of the best night after night?
To me, the most important is to enjoy it. I feel like it's such a nice thing to like be able to go on an NBA court and every night you have a different monster you have to guard and try to limit his possession and try to make his day a little bit harder. So, I take a lot of pride in that. Like I said, I'm just trying to make winning plays, try to help my team win as much game as possible, and put ourselves in winning situation. And I'm able to have an impact on those players. I'm just keep doing that.
So Dan, Tumani has this nickname, The Box, where when Anfernee Simons on the team plane announced to Tamani and the whole squad earlier this year that Tamani had been named the Western Conference Defensive Player of the Month. So he announces it and all the players are like, box, box. And everyone's like clowning on Tamani. And I'm like, I don't know what that means or what's the origin story of the box. But Tamani, can you show the people what the box is, your celebration, the gesture that you do, and where did this come from?
Yeah, so it's just drawing a box, you know. But yeah, the first time I seen this was on a football field, watching a lot of DBs and stuff like that. Because, I mean, I take a lot of pride in defense, but as a DB, as a corner, it's a completely different game. That's all you do, try to stop somebody one-on-one. And you're really on an island the whole time against very fast. And it's all about athleticism and read the feet and stuff like that. So I thought it was very impressive. And football players always have great celebrations, especially because they have the helmets and stuff. So they try to find a way to, you know, separate themselves from others. And the box was something that I never seen on a basketball court before. And me getting stopped and stuff like that, I feel like I need to try to find a way to identify myself with something. And that's the symbol that spoke to me the most.
We've had a lot of opportunities to do that, as Tom mentioned, all the stops that you've been generating this season. And the Blazers, top 10 defense since the beginning of January, like really rising up the charts with your young team there. I got to ask you about that one number that's part of that stops number, though, Tumani. 31. That's how many charges you've drawn this season, which leads the league by a lot. It's awesome to be great at something, but be honest, do you ever regret being great at that? Because that seems like it hurts.
Not really. It used to hurt when I was first taking them, but it's all about preparation. The same way as part of your game, the same way you shoot, you know, you're gonna get a lot of shots. You're gonna focus on how can you be more efficient in that. So when I take charge, I kind of like learn how to fall and how to not really hurt myself. I used to wear tape on my wrist. If you look at me last year, I had a bunch of tape on all my hands because it was an adjustment. But being able to to keep on learning and get my body stronger and stuff like that, it's not something that I'm afraid of.
What is the charge that you took that made you realize I got to change the way I fall? Was there one that sticks out to you that you just like got destroyed in a charge where you just took your body out on the floor?
It was probably in college when I was at Georgia. It was me and Jackson Hedder. He was one of our walk-ons, one of my close friends too.
It's always the walk-on.
we were competing with each other to try to see who's going to take the most charge all the time. And he was kind of pushing me to do that. And I feel like probably my first 2 years at Georgia was when it was really painful to take charges. But yeah.
Wait. You played with Anthony Edwards at Georgia. Did you ever take a charge against Anthony Edwards? And secondly, who would be a better DB, Anthony Edwards or Tumani Kamara on the football field?
I think Anthony would not play. I don't think he would play DB. I think he'd play wide receiver or QB. He wouldn't let himself be DB. But I think I'll give myself DB for sure. But no, I was not allowed to take charge on him at practice. No, but I'm just playing. But I wouldn't do that. I try to not take charge in practice. It's kind of reckless. Sometimes my instincts just take over. But I try to not to do that. So
you mentioned one of the big jumps from year one to year two. You know, you got to learn how to defend without fouling. You've cut that down. You're playing more minutes, but you're fouling less. You've made these improvements. And folks like us are fans that are on the outside to look and say, he's improved his three-point shot, or you could see he's working on his screen navigation. But that's where on the outside. What do you think you've gotten better at by made the biggest improvement at year one to year two, and kind of what's next for you as you look to continue to round out your game?
I'll say this past year, I think it's my maturity, just understanding the game better, being more patient in a lot of situations. I wasn't able to really work on my game this past summer because of my injury, the way I ended the season. So it took a lot of time off on me being able to work on myself. But I think it was at the same time needed from all the draft process and this crazy lifestyle. That was the first time for me to live. So it was a big adjustment. So it kind of helped me keeping my head cool. But I think my shooting got way more consistent. And I just keep on growing as an offensive player. I'm playing a different role than I ever played in my career. So it's a lot of adjustments, but it's a lot of games. So it helps me to grow throughout the season also. So, yeah.
Yeah, Tamani, can you explain what position did you play before you came to the Blazers? And why is this different than what you're used to?
I was kind of like a 4-5. So I was doing a lot of post-ups, guarding big mans and rebounding and setting screen, pick and rolls and stuff like that. So that's who I was. So it was a big adjustment for sure. But that's always who I wanted to be, guard, and kind of be able to play multiple position, depending on the matchup of the other team. Sometimes I'm gonna have to be a bigger guy and set screens and stuff like that, depending on matchups. And it's something I take a lot of pride in.
Which do you prefer, guarding up or guarding down, like dealing with the bigs or having to match step for step with some of those shiftier guards?
You know, the guards that are shorter than me and very shifty, I think it's probably the hardest for me to guard. Yeah. I mean, it really depends on how my body feels that day, but yeah. I like guarding all position. I just love to compete, be able to get on the floor and try to not let somebody score. It doesn't matter what type of person they are. Just trying to adjust.
Do you think taking charges is a form of rim protection, in the sense that, like, if you take a charge on a dude, you're not going to get a block and it's not going to show up really in the box score. But do you get the sense, Tumani, that after you step up for that charge, the opposing team is less likely to come down the key or think twice about if they see an open lane that they're like, ooh, Tumani might step up to take this charge? Do you see like an effect after you take a charge successfully in a game?
For sure. I start seeing people asking themselves more questions once they drive down the lane and see me coming on the help side. I feel like it's more hesitation and more looking to pass than try to go score. And also the biggest thing for me about charges is a turnover. It's automatically all ball coming down. So it's not really like a deflection or nothing like that. It's like a full-on stop. And then we got the possession now. So I feel like that's what is such a huge thing.
Do you think charges should be part of the box score?
Not as of today. I don't think enough people do it. I feel like it would be just a Tumani stats as of today, so I wouldn't do that.
Hey, you deserve that. Why not have a Tumani stat?
Yeah, well, you know, like, maybe one day, but we'll see.
Yeah. Most boxes created. Yeah, there you go. We'll throw that onto the box.
There you go.
Yeah, he's got box score. I mean, he's already got that trademarked. He's already got the. I mean, it's obvious that is what's named after Tumani Kamara. Tumani, you're coming into the NBA, 52nd pick. You're drafted by the Phoenix Suns, and then a trade happens with the Portland Trailblazers. What was that like? Like, your entry into the NBA was also a very chaotic one, where you're playing for Summer League, you have a chance to play with Kevin Durant and Devin Booker, and then all of a sudden you're moving to Portland. What was that like for you? And is it hard to imagine how far you've come in year two? You're already considered one of the best defenders in the NBA, named Defensive Player of the Month in the Western Conference. This has been a crazy 2 years for you.
Yeah, I think it was a very humbling experience. Make you understand the business you in right away. I mean, I was able to see the best of the best. I mean, Kevin Durant, Bradley Beal, Devin Booker. It was a bunch of talent around me as a rookie. And it was my first time meeting them, being their teammates and playing against them. So it was a crazy experience. Amazing for me to be able to experience that. And then I got back to reality a little bit, got traded, understand the business, and then just had another opportunity in another NBA team, another franchise that I see how I could have an impact in. So I just took that opportunity with all I could have. And I mean, the talent that we have here, all the rookies that was with me last year, and then Donovan that we got this past year. So, no, I mean, I'm very excited what we got going on here, and I can't be happier.
Yeah, Dan, like about a week ago, Tumani, you got to play against Dyson Daniels. And it seemed like, for me, it was fun to watch how different you guys are, but also you're two of the elite perimeter stoppers in the league. Did you ever talk to him on the floor, or like have an extra chip on your shoulder just because you guys are considered two of the premier defenders in the league?
Yeah, for sure. I think maybe it was not as something that I really thought about, but I think unconsciously, like, it's something that, you know, I wanted to prove myself a little bit. Now we had T's back too, so it was good to have him also. It was a nice defensive game. I don't think it's something that I really paid a lot of mind to. I just try to go out there and be the same person, try to be consistent in what I do. But yeah, it for sure brings a little bit more fire when you have somebody that they compare you to, or yeah, those type of situations.
for the purposes of say there's some folks like we're both on the East Coast. Maybe not everybody is staying up past their bedtime watching mm-hmm. Blazers games. Give us the sales pitch on Denny Avdija. Tell people what they're missing and if they're not catching Denny Avdija right now.
They're missing a lot. I mean, it's a young guy that's getting better every game. He can do it all. He can drive, he can guard, he can make the right play, make the right pass, and he communicates a lot with his teammates and stuff like that. So, I think the sky's the limit for him, and that's very excited to be able to have him on my team.
Do you take notes on the way he gets and ones? Like what not to do, because he is so good at getting guys, like he brings the ball out, Dan, and just like is like kind of James Harden in this way where, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, where he brings the ball up and like dares the defender to swipe at it. And he is just going to get that bucket every time and get the call. So Tamani, do you watch Denny and how good he is at setting traps for the defenders and take notes on like, oh yeah, he's showing me what not to do as a defender.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And to me, it's his consistency. Every time down the lane, he's doing the same thing with a lot of patience and making the right play. And I feel like that's what's big. If you're doing something over and over and you're mastering it, it's really hard to stop, no matter what, you can do as a defender. It's very impressive. I learned a lot from him. And I think that's what we do. We learn a lot from each other. He's asking me a lot of things about my defense. I ask him a lot of things about his offense and I idolize a lot of his game, the way he's patient in the paint and making reads. It's impressive what he's doing right now.
What's the quintessential Tamani Kamara play? Is it a block? Is it a steal? Is it a stepping up and taking a charge? Is it a 24-second violation where you just get a guy and completely trap him? Like when you think about your favorite play of this season and we could like put it on a billboard for everyone to see, this is Tamani Kamara in action. What's the play that sticks out in your head?
Man, that is so tough because I feel like my brain doesn't work like that. So I feel like I'm just trying.
I'll give you one, the Paolo Banchero block where you go up, you have two of them in the same game. You go up with two hands and block them with two hands. And then on mm-hmm. another play, you go up with one and just stifle them above the rim. Which one was your favorite block of the two?
Probably the second one, not the one in transition, but the one in half court. Just because it was after the first one, so it was kind of like, okay, I'm gonna try him again, and then I think that's probably my best block that I had for sure.
And then not so much trying after that. You've tried a couple times, then not so much anymore.
All right, you got coming up here before you finish the season. You got LeBron, Luka, Steph. Which one are you most excited about to finish out the season in terms of a defensive assignment?
I haven't played against Luka with the Lakers, so I'm excited for that too. All of them, really. Stephen Curry, I feel like last time we played him in Golden State, I didn't really do a good job on him. I was getting screened a lot, so it would be a nice matchup for me to end the season on. And same with LeBron and Luka, we haven't beat the Lakers, so being able to play against them and try to get one, I think it's crucial.
Tamani Kamara, folks, like I would be scared out of my mind having to go against LeBron and Luka and Steph, but this is a guy who like gets up for these sort of assignments. And that's, I think, refreshing for fans to hear is that like they love playing defense. Tamani Kamara, one of the best in the NBA to do it. Tamani, good luck for the rest of the season. And 231 defensive stops. That's the big number for Tamani Kamara, Dan. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you for having me, man. Have a good one. Appreciate y'all.
All right, Dan, we got to give a salute, a Belgian waffle of congratulations and thank you to Tamani Kamara. What a season. What an interview. That was a lot of fun. Thank you to Tamani. Thanks to Emmy, Mike Stone, and the entire squad that works hard behind the scenes on this podcast. Please watch The Big Number on YouTube. Subscribe to The Big Number wherever you get your podcast. Leave us a 5-star review. Tell your friends. Tell your enemies. We want them on board too. And as Bomani Jones likes to say, if you give me a 4-star review, I consider you a hater. All right. No 4 stars, all 5 stars. Thank you. That is the big number 5. 5 stars, and appreciate you listening to the program. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Big Number, a special episode of The Big Number. Strap in, buckle in for that next week. And until then, be safe and please be nice to your bosses. Please. This Michael Malone thing and Calvin Booth thing is very, very disorienting. We'll be back next week. Hopefully all the head coaches will be still employed by then.